Blimey, okay, all right. Well, I can artificial intelligence, probably not my specialist subject.
Well, I'll pick up on the AI one in a minute.
I'll give it a go with your TFA. Maybe. Yeah, that would be great. Okay, well, I'll do my best. Certainly, I think from an insurer's perspective, and we're the broker, we're the people in the middle, obviously, but from an insurer's perspective, I think the biggest single thing that would affect how they would view and rate, if you like, an insurance policy for a firm, and that's not just financial advice firms, that's any firm, as you say, Ian, is about MFA or multi-factor authentication. And it's just become, I think, generally now so easy to switch on in terms of most of the proprietary operating systems that you'll be used to will have some form of it, and therefore it can be activated, or you can obviously go and make inquiries about something else. But essentially, just allowing any cyber criminal the ability to only know your one credential, your username and password. The multi-factor will share something else, whether it be a random number generator or possibly at times it might be a piece of information that only you would know or whatever else. But certainly the ones that we are typically used to generate a number or maybe generate an SMS message to your phone or find another way of sending you something to validate that you are the person that you say that you are. And what we're experiencing right now is that for most firms, even where they maybe want to try to insure against cyber attack, if multi-factor authentication isn't in place, it's extremely unlikely and almost impossible that we can arrange cover. Or if we could arrange any cover, the wording and the quality of that cover would be, we probably wouldn't recommend it, because you'd be asking, why are people paying that kind of premium when the cover really isn't going to support them when they need it? So without going into your checklist, I've had a sneak peek, and I know that may or may not be one of the things on there, but it's absolutely crucial to think about that. And it is a situation where it's either on or off. And I say that, and I'm sure there are many people here who, one example that we've had of a situation is we asked a firm whether they had MFA in place, and the answer to that was yes. And there was a little asterisk next to that on the form, and where the notes section comes in on the application, it said, we have put it in place, other than for the chief exec, who finds it all too difficult to really go through and do it. So the answer actually is not yes, the answer is no. MFA is not in place, because it's not in place across the whole organisation. And I do understand, and I do realise that it's a pain and it takes something to get used to, but I do wonder that if you were doing your online banking, Would you now, in today's environment, want to log on to your online banking and not have some kind of multi-factor authentication? I mean, I think we would change banks quite quickly. And it's just understanding the level of data that most financial advice businesses have. It's far more, in many ways, than a bank has, because a bank will know about transactions and it'll know about your national insurance number and your account numbers. But a financial advisor or a mortgage advisor or an insurance broker will often have health details, knowledge about a person's sexual orientation. It's hugely critical, really, to that. And your stat, Ian, about how many firms end up going, out of business following an attack, it doesn't surprise me, because I wouldn't want to call any of my clients and tell them that their data and that richness of data is potentially out there, either on the web or the dark web, for anybody to come and collect. So I think MFA is very much a key frontline defense, and I think you'd find it hard to really go without that. I think going on to your point about AI, I mean, I think the level of sophistication, again, you mentioned in your introduction, there is no level of shortage, if you like, of hands being spent by the cyber criminals. They have very, very sophisticated tools. And what we also see is that there's a market on the dark web for this kind of thing. So some cyber attackers are only really interested in getting the breach and then selling on how to expose your systems to ransomware to another cyber attacker. So there are layers of this. So their market isn't to come and actually come forward with the ransom themselves. They just set about identifying where your systems are weak, making sure that they can have that access, and they send it on to a second hacker who they experience is how to extort large levels of money from you. And I think with AI, certainly, you know, it does, you know, it astonishes me as a person who can't believe the pace the technology is growing, that if we see some of the deep fake videos, speech, you might even think you can call a client and go, is that good enough? But if you're not ringing definitely the right number and you're not quite sure, then to my mind, it would be so, so easy for that technology to be deployed. And you feel that you're doing everything right. You know, it's very quickly gone from, well, just give the client a call, make sure that is the client. But you now need to know, not just call them, but you need to make sure it is the client that you're dealing with on a level of, a number or a method that you've agreed. And actually then asking them for something that you would only know, I think, just to make sure they are who they say they are. So I think it's expanded in the AI piece, but I'm no expert. I'm sure you can speak more eloquently than I can on that, but it's definitely a problem.
Well, a few points that I think are relevant on the issues you just brought up. On the question of multi-factor authentication, and not all advisor software systems are using it at the moment, but you can be sure that they've got a plan to. I think, you know, I struggle to think of anybody that I'm not aware of that has a plan for that. There is a point firms need to think of. One thing that multi-factor authentication, and it's a byproduct, but one thing it will do is provide them with a very clear understanding of how many of their licenses are in use by an organization. So it's not uncommon for an advice firm to have significantly fewer licenses that they are paying for than the actual number of advisors they have using the system. MFA will break that. So a budgeting issue for all advisors to consider. You need to start thinking how many people you've actually got using a system and be ready to pay for the right number of licenses. And that is especially an issue for paraplanning firms, because you really should. And again, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but again, I mean, one does come across situations where paraplanning firms have one license from one client and then happen to use it for a whole load of other clients. That is an enormous data protection breach. Absolutely no, it goes on. But for the paraplanners, you might need to start talking to your clients about, you know, they're going to need their own license for each particular system that you use for them. That's a financial consequence of greater security. Talking of financial consequences, it's long been the position of the FCA, indeed it goes back to the position of the FSA, that if you cause a data breach, you are going to be expected to compensate the client for causing that data breach, which at a minimum is likely to lead you to have to provide some sort of third party protection for them, some form of insurance to the individual. That's probably going to cost you about £100 per client per year. That said, probably having to notify a client that you've actually lost their data may be the last conversation that you have with them. So from a reputational perspective, it's probably about as damaging as it can come, bearing in mind that, as Chris said, you know, financial advisors, I mean, if I wanted to run an organized, you know, cybercrime business, my biggest target would be financial advisors. Your fact finds have everything you need to carry out detailed identity substitution fraud. Why go after a few £1,000 in the bank account when you can go to the hundreds of £1,000s in the pension or on the platform? And these, they're not coming out publicly, they are happening quietly. Coming back to AI, yeah, I think really important for every advice firm now to have an AI policy across the business. Indeed, I'd go as far as to say an AI policy has to be an integral part of your cybersecurity policy, because unless you are dealing with a closed, private, large language model, the chances are the information, you know, if you're putting information into ChatGPT-4, be very worried. because anything you put into their general system is training their system, and it might well be that your client's data could be resurfaced by somebody else. You know, absolutely, any AI you look at, it's crucial to be asking a series of questions and be absolutely sure that the data that you're putting in is only accessible for you, and you're usually going to need a private commercial contract to do that. I can't think of any situation at the moment where you would not. So, you know, that we will do a further one of, we're going to have a series of these fireside chats. I'm sure there will be one on AI in the not too distant future, but things to be aware of now. I think that's a key one. Joseph, can I come back to you, and can we talk about actual things that can be done, actual things advisors can do to protect themselves? And one thing I think it's always important to consider in this situation is, how do you deal with a situation where you might have an encrypted message, but if the encryption has been personal to the individual, which in many situations it will need to be, what do you do about setting that information if the individual has left? And that brings up a whole load of issues around, you always want data encrypted in transit, but actually, do you need it unencrypted in your business? Albeit that you would hopefully have encryption across your own internal systems.
Yeah.
If you can talk about, you know, what are some things that can be done to address cybersecurity?
Sure. Yeah, it's quite an interesting dilemma. And it's one that not just in the kind of financial advice industry or financial services, it's one at a governmental level. They've been debating, and you may have seen it quite publicly, about should we decrypt WhatsApp, and should we force them to unencrypt it at an individual level. So it's the same debate that you're describing there, really, at a company level, and the levels of encryption. And interestingly, it's also a debate from a technology perspective as to where is the balance between user friendliness, and by user friendliness I mean someone being able to actually access a system. There isn't too many layers of multi-factor authentication. There isn't these apps you have to download with codes, and you know, a pigeon brings you a 6-digit PIN through letterbox, you know, things like that. It's got to be user friendly, but it's also got to be secure. So there's a balance to be struck, and that's a debate that has been going on for many decades and will continue going on moving forward. But I think balancing the need for that individual level encryption for security and privacy reasons, and then having organizational access to critical information if an employee or a client leaves, needs to be met. And I think there are a number of mitigations that can be implemented to address that, Ian. And Legado does that. So a couple of different options, and I won't go into too much detail here as to how that can happen, but things like a key escrow system can be implemented where effectively trusted third parties hold keys and can access the encrypted information at rest if needed. Role-based encryption. So encryption is provided to different roles, and different roles can unencrypt the information. So it may not just rest that encryption with one person, like an employee, and then they leave and you're unable to access that. There could be multiple roles which are able to decrypt that information. And obviously those roles have to be very carefully selected. There are backup and archiving options which could be used. So messages which are encrypted are backed up in other encrypted databases or data centers, which then if required could be unencrypted and gained access to. And finally, and this is one that we often have to implement as we work with many of the biggest UK financial institutions, is administrative controls. So providing controls to certain people of a certain administrative level to be able to decrypt information. And we have to do that from a regulatory purpose. What I would say though, final message on this piece, is it's better to have something in place in regard to encryption than nothing. And as Ian and Chris, you've both talked about, there are still many, many financial advice practices and financial services companies that don't have anything in place, no encryption whatsoever. It's going out via email. In some cases, it's going out via post, the Royal Mail, physical letters. So having just some level of encryption is a massive step forward than having no level of encryption. And then the debate as to whether it's too secure or it's not secure enough can begin to happen. But I can definitely tell you it's more secure than having nothing in place at all.
I think one of the points you bring out there, actually, it's important to highlight as well, is, you know, data security isn't just digital. Paper, you know, I mean, I did come across, I heard a story from an advisor who told me they went into their offices late one night and found somebody, a cleaner, reading some files, to which the excuse was the person was trying to improve their English. Cleaning cat company was sacked the next morning. You know, clear desk policies, all of these, everything around all forms of data. And we shouldn't forget analog data. We shouldn't forget the legacy files that might be stored at the back of your garage, probably should be well and truly under lock and key. All of these physical things. I think the reality today is it's actually far easier to secure digital records than it is analog records, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, there's an awful lot of analog data around there. Chris, can I come back to you and can we talk a little bit more about, you know, when it goes wrong, what you should be doing? You've already highlighted the support that there can be from having the right cover, and you've mentioned requirements for notifying data losses, but can we drill down into a little bit more detail into that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the key thing is really about the, again, much of this is set out in the ICO and GDPR rules as to what firms have to do, and it depends to the you know, the extent of the data and who it relates to as to the different time frames. But as a general observation, from the moment that you become aware that there may be a problem, you essentially have 72 hours in which to notify the ICO that an incident has or may have occurred. And within that notification, it will expect you to do certain things. So it will expect you to have some form of insight within 72 hours as to what's happened and why and the potential extent. Now, you can explain within that notification that you've got a team of people, cyber professionals on the friendly side, that are looking into your systems and they're trying to understand that. You can do that, and that will buy you more time. You will be given a tick for that. But if you haven't really made the notification within the requisite time frame, or the notification itself sort of says something like, well, I don't really know what to do, or I'm not sure how to approach this, then clearly that's going to be, you know, set alarm bells off at the ICO, and you're going to expect a probably quite a challenging set of conversations that will follow from that. And I think in the round, so the things that need to happen behind the scenes is there needs to be an analysis, and you can find firms, it doesn't have to be via insurance, but you can, you know, you can find people that will do this for you for a fee, and they can go and start to try and unprise the work of the attacker and get to the point of understanding what actually have they got, how did they get in, how long were they in, and what data might they have taken, and what the risks are of them publishing that on the web or selling the data to other malevolent organizations that are just going to use that in a different way. So the business owner has two problems. One is the business has stopped because obviously we can't continue because we don't have access to the data and we can't talk to our clients. And it has another problem now that is a regulatory one in terms of the ICO trying to, and you know, make it an informed notification about what's gone on. So again, in smaller businesses, where often you get a small management team of, you know, directors or shareholders or people working together, it's a hell of a lot of work, frankly, to try to do and try to coordinate in order to do that, whilst at the same time having a worry about clients turning up for meetings, you haven't got their data, you know, you can't, maybe you may be under their phone details, you can't call them, you can't email them, they might be emailing you. When they're emailing you, depending on what the hacker has been able to do, they might be getting emails back telling them that you've been hacked. You know, there's a whole plethora of things that right when you need to be focusing on your clients and thinking about them, there's a whole load of work that you've got to do that you may not be, as a financial advisor or mortgage advisor, it may just not be your forte. You may not just not want to deal with these things, and understandably so. You know, my skill set's in a totally different area. I can explain the problems, but I couldn't necessarily always resolve it. So I think it's at least having a plan that you can have thought about when you can, when you've got, you know, a kind of cold light of day moment, when you're not under the pressure and scrutiny of having to come up and make decisions. It's far better to make them without the real life scenarios there. And then having that plan that you can go, right, well, I've thought about this. This is what I'm going to do. These are the kinds of firms that I'm going to ring, because the time clock, 72 hours, isn't a very long time when you might be, understandably, in a little bit of a panic over how you're going to deal with this, and you know whether you can even fund the ransom and whether you should fund the ransom or any of those other things. So it's a real, you know, exploitative, difficult, pressurized system that the hacker or cyber attacker knows you are in. So they know exactly the position that they put you in, and they will obviously pull every string and every trick in the book to make that pressure so intolerable that for them, you just pay them. And that may or may not be the right thing to do even then. And that's what this, you know, having a suite of professionals on hand can help you say, yes, pay them or don't pay them, because it's not going to help you in this set of circumstances. But again, about data backups, and you mentioned that, and I think that's another thing, understanding what data you can recover. You know, do you check that your backups work? You know, what we do know is, as we've said, if the cyber attack has been inside your systems for several weeks or months, it may be that they've been able to corrupt your backups, depending on the cycle of backups that you have. So it's really important to check them regularly that happens. And again, I was struck when you were talking about some other things. I mean, you're quite right. I mean, we're all in, on the basis of we're desperate for the internet wherever we go, but don't use unsecured Wi-Fi networks. You know, there are just simple things that we forget. You know, don't, if you use an iPad, don't be tempted to give that to a family member to play on. Or, you know, we know in the office you might have very high grade Wi-Fi networks and security systems with them, but apply that to your own home if you work from home, or if you have members of staff that work from home. You know, if you have to pay for it for them, it'd be cheaper in the long run. You know, upgrade what they're working on at home to something that's more in keeping with what you do in the office. And it might seem an expense, but actually, you know, if there's a weakness somewhere in your system, somebody, you know, will find it, and that's what you need to try and just stop that happening as best you can.